With your permission and through you, just on a point of information, I think we are very privileged to have Transnet at present here today come to address us. It is also convenient for this committee, while making use of this moment then, through you, Chairperson, I would like to put a question to Mr. Molefe, the new appointed executive, and I also want to refer to a huge front page in rapport that with the minister that was appeared on.
Mr. Molefe.
Yes, on 8 May.
Okay, let's do that when we have Transnet presented.
Chairperson, unfortunately, I asked your permission to leave earlier as I have a very urgent other commitments. With your permission, if I can just ask the question now, then because I can't come back later.
Let's just brief Mr. Van Dalen to raise the question on your behalf, and then take up the time of the.
I'll do so. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Oh, that's fine. Can we have the department?
Thank you very much. I'm going to give you an overview of the supply development program as it stands today. Up front, I would like to say that both Eskom and Transnet are going through quite a major process of developing their next generation supply development plans. And these will be ready, I would imagine, around September, October. And my expectation is that those plans will provide a qualitatively and quantitatively new level of detail as to the thinking and the direction that the SOEs are going to be taking in relationship to procurement leverage. So what I'm going to be doing is really giving you the background where we are today, recognizing that I think it's critical that the committee is aware that the plans will be coming, and I think a whole new quantity of analysis and information will be available relatively shortly. I must also just apologize in advance. I do have a laryngitis, so if my voice goes a bit squeaky, please bear with me. So some of the slides, some of the members of the committee may have seen before, others may not have. I'm going to err on the side of giving the background and then focus in on certain specifics. So what I'm going to be going through in the presentation is the context for the supplier development program, the progress that has been made on the program, new initiatives, and then a special note on the locomotive fleet procurement, which is the flagship procurement in the IPAC. So, in 1976, investments in fixed infrastructure, public investments in fixed infrastructure, peaked at about 16% of GDP. When 1994 came, it had dropped below 5%. Where it remained really until about 2004, where between the SOE and then later the government investment program, it started picking up again. I don't know if you remember, in Athesa we set a target of about 12% for public sector investment. Just a benchmark, had we been investing between 1994 and 2009 at 10% of GDP, we would have needed to invest another 1.5 trillion rands in 2010 rands. So there has to be an understanding that there was a gap in investment and that we've got a lot of catching up to do. The key insight I want to convey to the committee about that gap in investment is that when you stop investing, it doesn't only mean that your infrastructure serve services and infrastructure provision suffers. The companies that provide services and products, manufactured products and components to the infrastructure cluster also decline. And what this slide shows is how the value added in the transport equipment sector absolutely mirrored the drop in investments associated with government infrastructure programs. I think the other key insight for members to be aware of is that skills also tend to follow investment programs. So, for example, a simple example is if you find that we went ahead with the nuclear program, you would have a huge number of people starting to go to university, do courses in the nuclear area, because it acts as a logical magnet. Hey, there's going to be an industry, there's going to be a lot of job opportunities, there's going to be a future in this area. Similarly, if people pick up that there isn't being investment made in areas, they don't develop skills. So you tend to find a very, very high correlation between the two. The last point I want to make in terms of context relates to how the procurements were done historically. And what this slide shows is the procurement of locomotives. And you can see that in the 70s, we procured up to 250 locomotives in a single year. Between 1970 and, you know, around 1985, there was a real significant, large, lumpy program of locomotive procurement. The problem then being is that from 1987, the program just died. Now, I think the key takeaway is that had we been procuring at an average of approximately 80 locomotives per year over this 40-year period, would have sustained an industry, would have maintained the skills, et cetera, but by virtue of the lumpy procurement, you had a hell of a lot of investment in industry, and then demand absolutely collapsed, and as a result, industry collapsed with it. But one of the key takeaways, Honourable Chair, that I really want to emphasise is we cannot allow these lumpy procurements to happen again. Okay, they are disastrous. They result in exaggerated imports. They don't allow the emergence of a sustainable industry. We've got to learn from this lesson. So just to sum up the context is, our investment in infrastructure is an incredibly, incredibly leveraged mechanism to stimulate economic activity. And here I'm thinking of particularly economic infrastructure such as energy and logistics, what Eskom and Transnet do. First and foremost, it unlocks investment in customer industries through providing capacity to the customer. So a mine in Sishen will not be able to expand unless logistics capacity is provided to it to expand. So you provide the logistics capacity, you immediately get additional investment and employment in the mines. Very often, much more investment and employment in the mines than is generated by the investment in the infrastructure. By virtue of the infrastructure investment, you get improvements in the productivity and operations of your infrastructure service provider, which, again, enhancement in productivity simply means you're doing more with less. You're growing your economy. It enables the mines to do better. It enables the service provider to do better. The third level of multipliers, you unlock investment in supplier industries, what I've been discussing, the manufacturers of equipment and such like. So it's another level where you get employment and employment creation and GDP growth. And then finally, this is critical, you realize externalities. And the obvious example is the movement. If you invest in rail, you can move goods from road to rail. What are the advantages of having goods on rail? You decrease road congestion, you decrease road damage, you decrease environmental damage, you decrease emissions, and you increase safety. So there are major externalities that the economy as a whole will benefit from in pushing goods onto rail. But unless you invest in rail over and beyond the usual level of investment, you will not realize those benefits. And of course, the aim here is to build a virtuous cycle of economic growth. You achieve these multipliers, increased GDP, jobs associated, tax, you replow a chunk of that back into investment in infrastructure and the economy. It's on a progressive loop. So that's the broad context. Within this context, the DPE in about 2007 launched the policy of the Competitive Supplier Development Program. Now, the objective of the program is to create a foundation of demand against which the supplier industries, the manufacturers of locomotives, the manufacturers of transformers, et cetera, will feel confident, hey, it's worth investing in plants, in technologies, in skills to provide for the demand created by the SOE, because this isn't going to be a flash in the pan. You know, that they need to see the program rolling out in the long term. They need to see demand being steady and coherent. And then they invest and they build our national industrial capability. And it's a bit of a sidetrack, Honourable Chair, but I think this is an important thing for the Honourable members to understand. Manufacture is a very, very specific sector, because manufacture drives, you get productivity increases in manufacture through economies of scale, economies of learning and innovation that no other sector in the economy provides. So in other words, manufacturers has been the growth engine of industrialized economies because of this ability to enhance productivity, to enhance output in a way that no other sectors do. And of course, the disciplines that you get from manufacture do feed into other sectors of the economy, although you'll never get the productivity increases, say, in mining or in agriculture, in the way that you get in manufacture, which is much more knowledge intensive. So it's highly, highly strategic to the future of the economy, and this is what the Industrial Policy Action Plan is targeted at, in developing these supplier industries to SOE because they're manufacturing. So the purpose of the Competitive Supply Chain Development was to create a demand platform against which manufacturing could invest, because in a country at the southern tip of Africa, manufacturers will not invest, particularly in the capital goods and machinery areas, sectors, except for the local market and then secondarily for the African market. They're not going to invest in South Africa in order to access the Japanese or the Chinese or the American markets. And so it's in our hands to create that market for manufacturing capability. So the first step in the Competitive Supplier Development Program, and this is something I'll go into a bit more detail later, was to say to the state-owned enterprises, just give us a plan. Apply your brains as best as you possibly can and give us a plan as to how you think you can create this demand platform that would stimulate investments in your supply industries to reduce costs, to reduce imports, and to develop niche exports. Yeah. I think it's critical to understand, here's a graph that was developed by National Treasury, that if you invest in qualitatively new manufacturing areas that decrease imports, the growth impact will be double, if not more, the drop in imports. And why is that? It's because you're developing by developing, say, a new locomotive cluster, a new engine manufacturing facility, you've got to develop a whole new load of component manufacturers and service providers to that. So you get a multiplier effect on something that where the multipliers existed in the country where you are importing from. So it's very, very leveraged when you decrease imports through qualitatively new, developing qualitatively new industrial capability, as this graph shows, a 25% drop in imports has a relatively 100% increase in output from the national economy. However, this is the complex issue that we need to balance. If we give local industry too high a premium, in other words, if they're not competitive and we give them too high a premium, it means the SOEs are paying more in order to have locomotive produced nationally, which means they've got to charge more to their customers, which means the customers' profits drop, which means investment in the customer industries drop, robbing Peter to pay Paul. So there's a complex balance that has to be maintained, which I'm going to go through now. So don't try and figure out the slide. Let me explain it. I need to find a way of putting it more simply. There's a development economist called Mushtaq Khan. And what Mushtaq Khan showed was that you have a garment manufacturing, clothing manufacturing, which is pretty rudimentary manufacturing capability. You had the same, you had a company in India manufacturing clothing, a company in the USA manufacturing clothing using exactly the same equipment. The output in the USA factory was four times the output in the Indian factory. So the huge challenge for emerging economies is learning how to put capital and technology to work to be as productive as the developed country. That's what he defines as the industrial policy challenge. Those countries that have created conditions where their suppliers really apply themselves to overcome this gap in efficiency and knowledge, because the real gap is knowledge. How do you put this capital and technology to work? The point that he makes very, very clearly, though, is you're going to have to pay a premium initially because you're not competitive. So you're going to have to go through a learning curve to become competitive. So what's the challenge? You've got to balance the paying the premium for the learning curve with putting very, very strong incentives for the companies to actually learn and become globally competitive. Because the temptation in cases of failed industrial policy is suppliers become lazy and you just waste your money. So you can see it's a really, really complex challenge, this. Managing your suppliers up a learning curve for them to become globally competitive when you know they're not. There's not a textbook methodology for the SOEs to draw on which says how you do this. We have to learn by doing what does and doesn't work in South African circumstances to leverage our demand to develop our supplier industries in a way that optimizes their learning and doesn't get them lazy. So let me get back to my initial point. We didn't say, you know, do it this way to the SOE. We said, apply your brains and give us a plan as to how you think you can most effectively implement a program of this nature, because our objective was to optimize their learning process. So what this slide shows is that there are three components to the learning process. There's bottom-up execution. You need to have the SOEs empowered to plan and deliver on what they think they can do. The second area of this is accountability. You've got to show care from the top. And when I say accountability, it doesn't mean show us your results. It means let's see how you're doing. It's the same as when your child gives you your school results. Are you struggling with the teacher? Do you need extra help, etc.? It's accountability, but it's also nurturing. And the final area is providing support. You need to develop new capabilities to run these kind of programs. Okay? You need to assist the SOE in developing those capabilities. Okay. the output of phase one is learning about what works in practice. So if you think about our outcome-based education, where we restructured before understanding what works in practice, you restructure, waste a hell of a lot of resources, then find, oh, we don't have the teacher capability. The approach of the Chinese, of the Koreans, of the Japanese, is they're engineers. They start with what operationally works, and then they build on that. That's what we've been trying to do. So there are three phases to the program. The first phase, which we've been going through, one is building transactional capabilities, optimizing, trying to optimize the development impacts we can have in each procurement. The next is manufacturing partnership capabilities, procuring fleets to enter into strategic partnerships with international and national suppliers to systematically develop industry. And finally, the third phase is develop your innovation capabilities, partnering with both national and international to develop qualitatively new products and manufacturing technologies for the global market. So where are we today? We're presently moving from phase one to phase two, although enterprise capability remains weak and very uneven. I'm not sure if you're aware, honorable members, but Transnet and Eskom's capital procurement capability was closed down by government in 1994 because they were not allowed to invest. Okay? Because we were going to privatize, we were going to do all kinds of wonderful things. So we lost this. We are rebuilding from scratch. Now, we've made some significant progress, but let me give you an example. We trained a crack team of 14 people in Transnet. You will find them today leading Anglo-American procurement, leading Anglo-coal procurement, etc., etc. Huge leakage to the private sector because they'll pay huge amounts of money to have these people. There's a global shortage of them. So it's a continuous challenge. Now, when we think of this procurement leverage program, there are four different levels of complexity. There's shallow when we're thinking of construction or structural steel. It's within national industry capability. All we've got to do is plan properly, give them adequate warning, and they'll produce for the market. Now, for the World Cup stadiums, we imported structural steel. Bad planning. Okay. The second level of capability is intermediate. These are capabilities which we might have had historically and have declined, or we can easily develop. Companies can easily develop off their balance sheet. This is the area that needs a coherent medium-term demand signal from companies to get up the learning curve. The third area is advanced manufacturing capabilities. These are capabilities that integrate engineering and manufacturing processes, and companies are saying we want to see government support for technology transfers, government support for skills development, and government support for possibly IDC as an equity partner, skin in the game. And then we start moving up to much more complex areas of manufacturing. And then finally, you've got globally leading. These tend to be areas where you've got maybe 2-3 facilities globally, where the government might, PBMR, where the government might invest in something for strategic economic purposes, but it would not be viable for the private sector. So Eskom did an analysis, and this gives you a sense of, you know, how our capabilities sit based on their analysis. And you can see, in terms of the Eskom demand profile, we should have the capability to produce 90% of what Eskom require of shallow capability. But here's the scary stuff. In terms of this intermediate stuff, we only presently have the ability to produce 16% of the requirement of Eskom's build program because industry was so decimated by the drop of investment. So this intermediate capabilities, which is the bread and butter of a component manufacturing industry, we lost. In advanced capabilities, we can produce about 8% of the content of the program, and Eskom has the target of moving us up to 36%. But this gives you a feel of that our manufacturing sector is not in great shape. We did another survey. We've got a benchmarking program with UNIDO that, based on those benchmarks, showed that 40% of SOE suppliers would be categorized as weak or vulnerable. So, in other words, not up to scratch. There needs to be a significant effort in just getting them up to a solid efficiency level before we can start thinking of taking them, building any additional capability. Oops, sorry, I went the wrong way. So, Honourable Chair, I'm going to put on the table that we are struggling with giving you a comprehensive picture, both in Eskom and Transnet, of the state of the programs. We developed a new tool for that in conjunction with DTI, and it's being piloted as we speak. Reasons for the struggle is, historically, the SOE have never had to record this kind of activity in their enterprise resource planning systems. So all the IT systems were just not set up for this kind of reporting. So we've really put considerable effort into developing, you know, a proper monitoring and reporting system. I'm just putting cards on the table, Honourable Chair. We're not there yet. But we are tackling it very seriously. But what one can say, and I can give you tons and tons of anecdotes. So this is an example. I'm sure I can give you 20 anecdotes from Eskom. But well over R1 billion in investment in manufacturing capability has been leveraged by Eskom through the supplier development program. Hitachi has invested about $900 million in facilities, and then a range of manufacturers from feed pumps, transformers, etc., have been made in the Eskom value chain. Eskom is presently engaged with some quite ambitious major industry development initiatives in niche areas. But I think as I was mentioning, Chair, the supply development plans, which will be ready in September, will give you a really comprehensive picture of those programs. Eskom, as you can see, through their suppliers, have leveraged the training of over 6,000 people. They've got plans to get workplace experience for 5,000 people per annum starting over the next few years. But this is just training they have leveraged through their suppliers. It is not training done within Eskom. As well as around Medupi and Kusile, Eskom has developed hubs, component development hubs, where the suppliers sit around the table with service providers and other key stakeholders and work out how we can do more in South Africa in relationship to that component. Transnet has really been focusing on locomotive manufacturing capability and has been on quite a successful journey in developing what is required to build a world-class manufacturing industry. So there have been deals with electromotive diesel, and there have been deals with GE and with Mitsui. And the essence of these deals has been to develop, sometimes it's been the private sector, UCW and DCD Dorval, and sometimes it's been within Transnet Rail Engineering. It's that learning curve. At the start of the program, their quality control systems, their production systems, their inventory management, the way they design their production flows were just from the 70s. OEMs and these suppliers have literally invested hundreds of millions in getting the basics right to produce about a third of the locomotive's value, which is predominantly the mechanical, the more easy stuff to produce, but to produce that properly at a world-class level. And that has been successful. We've now got, I believe, a very, very firm foundation. But these deals have been complicated because they've involved technology transfers, they've involved skills development, they've involved people going over to overseas plants to see how production is organized, and people from overseas coming to our plants to mentor and supervise. But just for what would be considered this basic shallow and intermediate area of locomotive manufacture has been a huge challenge to get us up to speed. In certain areas, I can say we're not yet there, but we're making very good progress. Transnet has also put significant effort into developing their procurement capability within the organization and in developing collaboration forums with they launched the Rail and Harbours Industry Association, Supply Chain Association, in order to enhance communication with their suppliers. And as well, they pioneered the benchmarking program with suppliers. Now, as I've mentioned, a key challenge that we've got is that we've inherited a weak SOE planning and procurement planning and execution capability. And when planning is ad hoc and done off a degraded balance sheet, when execution overemphasizes engineering issues, is stop-start because of the balance sheet, does not allocate risk sensibly, you get poor industrial outcomes because suppliers will not invest for that company. So hence we introduced the fleet procurement. The fleet procurement was really saying for key items we've got to make sure we don't miss the opportunity. And what the fleet procurement is saying, we need to identify certain areas like locomotives, like certain port equipment, transformers, etc., that we know we're going to need over a long period. We need to structure these procurements over the long period to send a clear signal to industry about our demand. We need to partner with international and national industry for that long period of time to take them from this 33% level of industrial capability up to the 80% level of industrial capability. But that means entering into a highly complex procurement relationship with the OEMs and with national industry. And that's the underlying concern behind the fleet procurement. Now, what we've done is we've developed a draft policy within the DPE to guide the supplier development process. And the essence of the draft policy is to have external review panels, and this is based on the Gateway policy in the UK and a strategy used by the UAE. In their nuclear procurement, you have external review panels reviewing the procurements at critical moments to make sure that rigorous analysis has been done at each stage of the procurement to optimize the chance of getting the best outcome. So we've got a policy to guide the fleet procurement, and what we've done is identified the key moments in the fleet procurement process, ensured that an appropriate governance process is put in place to manage the quality of the process. And this is necessary because the risk profile of a fleet procurement, because of its sheer scale, its duration, and its industrial complexity, is higher than any other procurements that we're going to be doing. And given that the SOEs have relatively low procurement capability, we've got to manage the quality of the process very carefully. Transnet and Eskom have put considerable effort now in developing transactional procurement policies, which means that into the future, any procurement above a critical threshold will have a supplier development component in it. So it really, what we've seen is this first phase has been experimenting, finding out what works and what doesn't work. The phase we're entering into now is to make sure that the capability to leverage supply and development is integrated into every single procurement that takes place. And then finally, we've got an innovation policy, which just means that South African suppliers that come up with a new innovation, so say a new port tractor, until that tractor is tested in industrial conditions, they will not be able to compete. So they're at a disadvantage. What this policy enables is for the SOE to provide them with a testing platform in a controlled, risk-managed manner. What we've also done is we've developed a business plan, and we'll be going on a fundraising process for a center of excellence in procurement to support this procurement building program. The aim of the center of excellence is to provide very, very focused support, so for a locomotive fleet procurement, to try and get top experts in the locomotive global supply chain to provide the SOE with mentorship and coaching to take them through a process that they've never been through before. Okay. On top of it, it will become a place where knowledge is stored, where training programs are developed, etc., etc. So within that context, we've got the locomotive fleet procurement, which we've launched. The average age of the Transnet fleet is 33 years old. To put that in perspective, the average age of the American Class 1 railroad is 15 years old. These locomotives are beyond their design lifetime. Okay. The access to locomotives has become, reliable locomotives has become an absolute constraint on growth. An absolute constraint on getting particularly bulk goods from the mines to the ports. So we're structuring a 15-year program to fundamentally modernize and lower the average age of the Transnet fleet. So just to give you an indication of what's involved, if we buy, in order to keep the fleet at 33 years old and keep it at its present level of capability, we've got to be buying 70 new locomotives a year. Okay. So everything above 70 is starting to address the age problem and starting to address the fact that we simply don't even have enough capability to get the stuff to the port. So we have a major need for new locomotives. This is just a slide done by someone at the University of Stellenbosch that says, you know, to get adequate investment in locomotives, I believe it's critical that money from outside the balance sheet, in other words, some form of grant money, moves into the rail sector. And what this is arguing is that the road externalities relating to emissions, accidents, etc., cost the country about 34 billion rand per annum, which would be significantly decreased if you move goods to rail. But we're not going to see this decrease unless we see a coherent, concerted program by government to move goods to rail. Now, what this slide does is I'm trying to briefly give you a sense of how strategic nationally this decision is as to what locomotive to buy. So you're balancing four different factors. First of all, capital cost, cost of the locomotive. But then there are two other variables that you've got to look at. The life cycle cost, so you can get a cheap locomotive that uses a lot of petrol, that constantly needs servicing, whose parts are very expensive, etc., etc. The life cycle cost is very high. The opportunity cost of that locomotive would also be very high because it will break down, it will continuously be requiring maintenance. And then finally, there's a link to industrialization. This is key. If you buy a cheap locomotive, you're buying old technology. You are locking your industry and your industrial capabilities around old technology. You are not building your industry to be positioned for
exports, to use the capabilities built in locomotives to be applied in your automotive industry, to apply it in your chemicals or heavy earth moving equipment industry. Why? Because you've organized it around antiquated technology. So the ramifications of the kind of locomotives that you buy are manifold. And I think it's critical that the Oversight Committee keeps a very, very sharp eye to make sure that this strategic decision is made with adequate thought and care, because it is going to determine the nature of the South African economy in many, many ways. So I'm just going to give you an example. If you take, for example, a Zambian railway, low-volume railway, very, very unsophisticated national industry, it might make sense to buy a cheap locomotive, because that means the parts are low-tech. They're easy for a low-tech industry to provide, and it doesn't matter if your life cycle costs are relatively high and your opportunity costs are high, because you're keeping your national industry busy producing those parts. But if you've got a busy network like we've got, and we've aspirations for a highly technologically advanced industry, you want to buy a locomotive that supports that. The next point that I wanted to make, and this is the second to last slide, is that we've done a lot of research into the impact of a fleet procurement in locomotives. Presently, we're producing, as I mentioned, about a third of the local contents for locomotives in South Africa. Our research suggests that we've probably got another 8% that is easy for us to access. But then over a 10-year period, we believe we can stretch ourselves to achieve another 40%, so that we're in the 80% level of national value add by virtue of doing this fleet procurement. I just want to give you a sense of the importance of the South African market for heavy haul electrical locomotives. Our analysis suggests we will be the biggest market outside of China. And so the OEM will, in order for them to access this market, will have to come to the table in building South Africa as a very significant locomotive hub into the future. So we're significant in the areas that we play. So this is the last slide. Is in order to implement this program properly, we're putting in place a new governance arrangement where the minister is putting an oversight committee involving himself, the minister of DTI, and the minister of economic development, to have oversight of the supply development program as a whole, and particularly of the fleet procurement. Because the fleet procurements cannot be done by the SOE alone. They don't have the money and they don't have the capability. Okay? So as well as we're going to have task teams reporting to that ministerial oversight committee, identifying areas that need intervention and providing the ministers with briefings and initiatives to unblock that. And again, I'd call on the Oversight Committee to keep a close eye on this process. Just to reiterate what I said from the start, in terms of kind of detailed plans and achievements from the SOE, by the end of September, both Transnet and Eskom will have developed their lessons learned, their next generation plans. I would humbly propose to the Oversight Committee that would be a really, really good time to get a lot of information very organized for. Thank you very much.
I will now invite members to raise questions or to interact with the presentation. But before that, let me just ask one or two questions that I'd like to. And that's really with regards to the challenge around this new multi-product pipeline. What are the challenges that you've come across this? And also on your long-term plan around procurement, focusing on local suppliers to assist them actually to build their own capacity. Let me leave it at that. I've noted, I want to start this. Mr. McQuarrie, Dr. McQuarrie, I see your hand. Honorable Dr. Kuranov, Honorable Bowman, Honorable Van Dalen, Honorable September. That's it. I'm going to appeal to members. Let's try to be as brief as possible. Let's not have more than three questions so that we don't eat into the trust at times. Honorable McQuarrie.
Yes. Thank you, Chairperson. Let me start by welcoming
you. Honorable Santa, you didn't have your hand up.
Let me start by welcoming the presentation. It's very informative because.
Pardon? Yeah, I know. I wasn't sure about his, but I'm aware that you didn't write it.
I felt honorable Nana was joining me in welcoming the.
No, he's just registering his presence.
Me too. Yeah, it's a very, very informative and insightful presentation because what it does, it elevates procurement to very high levels and into the global arena. That's the first point. Second point is quickly is a question that the lumping of the procurement. What are the strategies, what informs the decision to close down procurement in 1934? I see, Edwin, you said in your presentation that one of the tragedies that were caused by in the area of procurement was to actually close down the procurement in 1934. Now I want to know what was the reason, what was the reason behind that, what that could inform us how to proceed. As a first, just unpack that a little bit. Number two is that we spoke about the lumping of procurement. What was also the strategy in the lumping? Because you think does not in the foresight does not present but what was the logic? You see, because those of them are perceived as mistakes. And if we just sweep them under the carpet and say those are just historical mistakes, let's forget about them. We're not going to learn how to proceed into the future. Right. Finally, Chairperson, the third question is, I'm interested that there is this IPC, this Interministerial Procurement Committee. Now, I would like Edwin to factor in the new development that we've had in the media now that they came to Cairo, integration of 26 countries with half a billion population, etc., etc. Let's factor your presentation into that thing because what it does then is we are no longer transferred as ESCOM and these other parties, no longer, SOEs are no longer now. I want to be focused as South African, similar South African enterprises. They'll go beyond that to South Sudan and stretch over the whole continent, spanning the gamut of 26 countries at the moment, with the prospect of unfolding further.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you so much to the Department for a very informative presentation. I think it's a fresh breeze of fresh air that I can see from the department embarking on this initiative. I think it's good. I think it will be good for the country at the end of the day. I agree with you with your last slide, the role of the oversight committee to look at the next generation supply development plans. But we should not only, it starts in the third term then, and to the fourth term this year, but we should not only be looking at the plans, probably also start to look at the implementation and progress made. Three questions. One, you started off on page 3 on the fixed capital formation of private sector, public corporations, government. Surely this whole initiative is a partnership of all involved, not only the SOEs, but also labor, business, private sector, and also entities in civil society. I just want to make sure that we're talking a global, or not a global, a national initiative where we mobilize all forces to grow the South African economy, not to the exclusion of one another, but it's a national-driven initiative where the SOEs play a very important role, but everybody is welcome to contribute to. We know who will drive it and who will initiate it, but it's a national effort. That's my first question. Number two, just talk to us about the funding. Who will fund this? And where will be the funding? It's a broad question, but if you can just address that issue. And lastly, parallel to this process is the Presidential Review Commission. And I just want to see what bridge there is between this initiative and the to-be-awaited report of the Presidential Review Commission by the end of this year. And whether you in consultation or they talk to you in preparing their report eventually to the President, but also again to the government and to the Parliament.
I can be brief because I've been well covered already, but I just want to also add here, I like the idea of your emphasis on the quality of what we are producing, and I do believe that quality does give us very good returns. But I want to just say I really have a concern. We are nearly 3 years into our term of office, and what concerns me is that we're always making new plans. And I'm just wondering if you've got some idea of, does this kick in? I missed part of the beginning of the presentation, so I apologize for that. But and I think the presentation is very exciting. I think the whole thing with the BRICS countries and all of that in Africa developing, I think it's fantastic, and that we will play such a huge part in all of that. And so my question really is, how long do we make the plans and look ahead? And important though that is, I'm not decrying it. The other thing was also just related to the funding. And you mentioned that, grant, some sort of grant is going to be needed for this, and yet we're hearing that government, is not going to be pumping money into SOE. So I'd just like a bit more clarity on that. Thank you.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairperson. When you go international to apply for funding to the BOLT program, like Eskom has done and obviously Transnet also done, it obviously comes with conditions. So some of these loans that you get would, the condition would be that you procure it from that country, and it's like the deal with the Eskom where they apply for funding, and RAM is a company in Africa which would supply roof bolters for the coal mines, are now having to close down because we have to procure the roof bolters now overseas at more expensive because it's part of the loan condition. How will this new procurement that will affect local procurement, how will it affect the local procurement, or will we take a stance and say, well, we won't procure from you, we will rather do it locally, or conditions. And then I wanted to know, you know, we went to visit this Transnet Rail Engineering where they had told us that they don't have an order book for locomotives and they are struggling to survive because nobody wants to buy into their program. And they had built, I think, the 50S new locomotives as well. So now I want to know, why are we procuring the stuff from G&E if we can actually build them in South Africa itself? Why did they told us that we can build them? We saw them being built here in South Africa. And then I want to know the difference in the price. If you buy one from G&E, what does the locomotive cost and what will it cost to have it done here? I've heard that it costs about R1 billion for a locomotive. That would put it close to a jumbo jet price, you know. It's very expensive. And if we can do it cheaper inside of South Africa, it's much better. But maybe you can answer it. I mean, you probably have to answer what it costs. And then the last question, I would like to know, you know, the firing of the board of Transnet or the uncertainty about the firing of the board. How would this affect what you have presented to us today? Because obviously the board of Transnet would have to have the buy-in of what you are saying. And how would you manage this process? Thank you.
Thank you for that protection, Chair. Let me also say that I also welcome the presentation that was given yesterday. Chair, the kind of presentation that we had today obviously gives the committee an opportunity to really talk a little bit more about economic infrastructure. And the first issue that I want to talk about is there was a 5-year plan that the department had, which amounted to R165 billion, and that was earmarked for transport and electricity in the main. I'd like to know, everything that we have said here today, does it build on that, or is it just a complete fresh start? Because if it is so, what has happened to that program? Because it will address the question that the member here in front of me has asked. Is it completely anew? I'm asking that, Chair, because I would totally agree with the department deciding that, you know, they are a driver of growth. Also, there obviously has got to be some consistency. And the other issue that I want to address, Chair, is maybe it will help that the signals that we send out must be signals that would support the following. So part of mine is not just to ask questions, but to make some suggestions also, Chair. I think all of us know that economic infrastructure exists not because to support various kind of economic activity, but it will help in any future presentation that they do show us a little bit more what kind of economic activity other than the locomotive are envisaged with, you know, a program such as this that was given here today. We all know that, you know, the public, one of the difficulties of the public sector when it comes to infrastructure expenditure is that, you know, it can do so only up to a particular point because the public sector relies on taxation in the main. So I think it's got a My question here has got a link up with the previous question that was asked, and that is government at some point will have to raise money, and mostly it raises it through taxes in the country. Now, in this program, where there's only a particular portion in here, are you going to have a continuation with a reliance on the taxation, which is not bad, and also from other, you know, from other sources? And how do you put both of these together? Because because that for us is quite important chair in this instance, that you know, it raises the marginal product of capital. And so I think that's what we're interested in. When it comes to the state, you know, the marginal product of capital goes down like that unless there's an injection of taxes all the time. But Chair, as I end off, I would have been interested that the presentation include the report that the South African Reserve Bank brings out all the time on the public sector on economic infrastructure. If you have any, if you don't have it here, I think it will be important to give that to the committee, because I think it will be good if we can juxtapose what you have said here against the reports that they publish, and to what extent does it influence you or not what they publish. I lastly are interested, Chair, to look at obviously the long-term relationship. If you can provide us again with the long-term a report on the long-term relationship between the economic infrastructure and the real GDP of the country, and particularly because of what you have said earlier on, there was that particular period where nothing occurred, which is referred to as this plateau period. And in order for us not to have that plateau period ever in the country, for the other people referred to the 1996 class project, so that we don't go back to this 1996 class project again, I'd like to know if you can include that section also. You know, Chair, these things are quite interesting how they are being developed. And I that's why I'm asking that we probably get this right. Because if you look at what happened in this country when gold and diamonds were found, I'm by 1C now, Chair. I'm not by number 3 yet. It's 1C. It will be interesting, Chair, to if we go back and look at, you know, what happened in the 1800s when they discovered gold and when they discovered diamonds, how they connected the transport to this. Surely we wouldn't want that sort of situation, because it was not a strong economic argument at that point, and that's why I'm asking what I am asking, Chair. Lastly, I think that the presentation must also include the need for infrastructure investment from the national level to the municipal level also, because we'd like to know, you know, at the national level they should be in sync with what they are doing at the municipal level, or the other way around, of course, to make sure, I don't know how we're going to catch up that period between 1970 and 2002, where there was that slump plateau period. Are you ever going to make it up? But nevertheless, I'm sure the world is there. I thank you for your patience, Chair.
A process of managing the design and construction
of a highly, highly technologically sophisticated project, and that requires a high level of capability in the buying organization that I think, in my view, we'll find is in short supply, and was in particular short supply because these capabilities were closed down in both Eskom and Transnet in 1994, because the Department of Public Enterprises in those days was called the Office of Privatization. What do you need a capital procurement capability for if you're going to be privatizing these entities? You know, all they're trying to do is somehow defend their position. So that was the context in which it was closed down. But the DDG can go into more detail on the pipeline. So, in terms of the Lundy procurement, we're chatting to an old transmitter in a workshop a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, as we opened up a new railway line, we bought a whole lot of new locomotives for that railway line. And, you know, there was the commodities boom in that period. The country was awash in cash, and government was pumping money into the area. But so you've got 27 or something different classes of locomotives on the Transnet fleet at the moment. There's no standardization at all. And so they would just buy here, there, and everywhere, if they had the money, for each new thing that came along. And of course, they truly believed they were doing the right thing. I think in terms of fixed capital formation, we are committed to this partnership approach. What I've been describing is the building of partnerships with national and international suppliers, original equipment manufacturers. But we're very committed to building a partnership with our customers, because in many cases on these bulk commodity corridors, there are few customers that are using all the capacity. And it's appropriate that they share the risk of building this infrastructure. And there are many cases from around the world where they are sharing the risk. However, I think at the same time, we need to bring in our very, very sophisticated and developed financial services community, our DFIs, the asset management companies, the pension funds. As I think we can define a very, very good structure for them to participate in these processes and ensure, you know, a level of honesty and rigor, through their participation. So we are very, very committed to unlocking all sources of capital in a partnership type style. I think in terms of, but having said that, there will be an area, particularly for rail, where, and you see this in passenger rail, the Prasa situation, which requires a huge recapitalization. But you also see that if you want to move goods from road to rail, particularly marginal goods, where it doesn't make much difference to the customer whether it goes by road and rail, you know, you've got to give rail a form of grant. And you've got to penalize road for the negative externalities associated with that mode. And if you don't, you will not realize the positive externalities. And that funding is purely a question of political will. You know, and that's what I'm signaling to the Oversight Committee, is we need to equip you with the information and analysis to build that political will for this kind of intervention. Presidential Review Commission, we're engaging. To put it to, you know, we're engaging with them, we're sharing experiences. View the Commission in a very, very positive light. The key thing about this process is it's not just planning. You know, we are doing procurement in a developmental way as we talk today. You know, I've got a from Transnet, I've got a kind of log, you know, matrix of procurement at different stages with their supplier development proposals. But it's commercially sensitive because it's how these suppliers are differentiating themselves. So that's why we need to find a way of sanitizing and sharing it with you in a comprehensive, proper way. And I'm begging your pardon because we're not there yet. But it's not just planning. But what I am emphasizing is the better our planning, the more long-term our planning, the better foundation we make, the better the outcome we're going to get. DFI conditionality, you know, it's a problem. We've got to raise the money from South Africa, you know, because those DFIs are there to, be it the World Bank or be it an Export Credit Association, they are there to push their members' interests. And the development of South African industry is not part of their loan conditions. In fact, it's the opposite of that. So we have to raise the capital from South Africa. It's as easy as that. TRE are part of the GE 100, but their capability is only that 33%. It's only to do the assembly, eh? And even then, there's a huge learning curve for them to do it efficiently. So we've invested hundreds of millions of rand, part of these procurements, in re-engineering their processes, developing their skills to become world class, because they're not there yet. Price of locos, 25 to 40, depending, you know, whether it's diesel, electric, how bespoke it is, on what corridor it works. That's 25 to 40 million rand. Interesting thing, much cheaper. You know, and this shows you that matrix capital in industry life cycle costs. When we initially had an order, a rushed order for 100 locomotives to the national community, we got a price of X. And then the global recession happened and we had more time. So we planned it properly and we said to them, please resubmit, but increase the level of localization significantly. Level of localization for that order was 10%. The prices dropped by around 25%. Like it makes more sense to produce a bunch of these things, to do a number of these processes in South Africa. What causes the inflation of procurement prices? It's bad planning. Okay? So you've got a good procurement capability, you win. You get good capital costs, good life cycle costs, good industrialization. The role of the Board of Transnet is to carry out the shareholder mandate. What individual is in place is not our concern as officials, just to make sure that the mandate is carried out. I hope I'm not going to be fined for giving that answer. So how does this relate? You see, this builds on the 650-odd billion that's in the plan relating to Eskom and Transnet. The point of this program is it's ensuring that the investment money we spend it in a way that we optimize our value for money and the impact on the economy. So it's taking something we have to do anyway and leveraging it to the best result. So I think I've answered the taxation and other income. Look, Reserve Bank uses data they get from us, but essentially what the Reserve Bank graphs will show is that while public expenditure was flattening out and private expenditure was decreasing during the recession, it was Eskom and Transnet and Eskom in particular that was retaining the momentum of fixed asset investment during the recession, which cushions the blow, and that's what a Reserve Bank graph will tell you. And now we see those other programs beginning to pick up. What you're asking, long-term relationship between economic infrastructure and GDP growth, wonderful question. A lot of econometric models have developed on that. I think we should have a course in our school, to unpack this. But intuitively, one knows, infrastructure is a constraint or an unblocker of growth.
I'm happy, Edwin. I think he's covered the question, and yeah.
That then brings us to the end of this presentation and this interaction.
Sorry, Chair. There was some questions not answered. If it can be answered now, I would suggest that they forward them. I mean, I did ask about the 165 million project. And so on.
Okay, I think like Honorable September says, those can be forwarded, responses can be forwarded to members. Let me thank you, Department, for this presentation. And this part of the meeting is an agenda. We will break for 10 minutes. Then hopefully, Transnet will be ready to. Give their
Oh, you just phone ringing. I don't know how to switch it on silent. I haven't figured it out.
Yeah, that's weird.
So I put the volume down completely, but it's still ringing and making a noise.
Oh, yeah.
It's like an iPhone. I got it 2 weeks ago, but I haven't had time to sort it to figure it out. Got it from the work, so they forced it on us, and said I have to try to figure this thing out.
I've got that thing before.
Yeah,
and it's taking
all the little sounds to make it.
Probably understating the
happened, I think I got like 8.5 hours sleep last night.
I tell Transnet, but before that, I'm going to request the CEO of Transnet to introduce his delegation. We're not going to introduce members because Transnet was in the room when we did the first introduction. So we'll just have the Transnet delegation introduce
themselves. Chair, thank you, Chair. I'm Brian Molese, Group Chief Executive of Transnet. We have with us two board members. We have with us three board members. Mr. Don Kwanazi, who's entering now. Mr. Peter Moyo. And then Ms. Nunu Chingi. Mr. Peter Moyo is the chairman of our audit committee. Ms. Nunu Chingi is the chairperson of our remuneration committee. And Mr. Don Kwanazi is the chairperson of our acquisition and disposal board committee. And then we also have Mr. Carl Antisotriqua, who is the chief executive for Port Terminals, Mr. Komodo Pisela, who is the group executive commissioner, Mr. Mark Greg McDonald, or the master. Okay, Mr. Peter Moyo, who is standing there, and Ms. Nunu Chingila right next to her. And then Mr. Kantiso Tigwa, who is the group executive for Port Terminals, Mr. Komodo Pisela, group executive commercial, Mr. Mark Greg McDonald, group executive planning and strategy, Ms. Zola Stephen, group executive corporate affairs, Ms. Virginia Dunjo, chief risk officer, Mr. Lenny Moodley, Deputy Chief Executive for Transnet Pipelines, Ms. Ayanda Deva, Group Company Secretary, Mr. Mboniso Skonyela, Group Communications, Ms. Phyllis DeFeto, General Manager in the Office of the Group Chief Executive, Mr. Rodney Wolfenden, Internal Audit, Mr. Richard Vallejo, Chief Executive Transnet Rail Engineering, and Ms. Moira Moses, Group Executive Transnet Capital Project. So, Chair, if I can move immediately to the
question asked at the start of the meeting by Dr. Van Dijk before he left. And I think I owe the committee some feedback because I presented the matter in the meeting before the last one. Say what, where the process was with regard to the TSDBF. And before we came to this meeting this morning, I had made contact with the office of the DG of the department, and just to find out where we are or how far we are with regard to getting a report to the committee, and also whether or not the matter was tabled before the last Transnet board meeting. I did not get hold of the DG, but someone in the DG's office who is aware of this process then phoned to say that the matter was tabled before the Transnet board. The report will be given to the department on Wednesday, and we will then have to decide on a date on which we will get the report from the department. Honorable Pandara.
Yes, Mr. Chairperson, thank you very much. I have spoken to Dr. Mani van Dijk. We are happy with your explanation and we accept that. Thank you.
South Africa and enabling economic growth through appropriate, providing appropriate ports, rail and pipeline infrastructure and operations. And so that is what our role is in the economy. If we go into the specific question that was asked about progress with capital investment, over the last 5 years, we have invested about 87 billion, funded without the government guarantee or without transfers from the fiscus. So the 87 billion was funded on the strength of Transnet's balance sheet. The 27.9 of the 87 billion went into pipelines. 13.5% into ports and about 58% into rail during 2010-2011. The major capital investments have been the purchase of 94 locomotives. The detail is in the presentation about the classes of locomotives. 354 wagons. The refurbishment of about 442 locomotives and 12,900 wagon liftings, as well as infrastructure replacement, rail, 555 kilometers of rail was replaced, and 292 kilometers of railway sleepers were converted from wooden sleepers to concrete sleepers. And 528 kilometers of screening of the track. In the port, we bought tugs for the Port of Devon and Richards Bay. We bought one dredger and cargo handling equipment and facilities, rubber tired gantry cranes for the Cape Town Container Terminal. I think Mr. Van Dalen earlier was saying that the cost of a locomotive is a billion. The cost of a dredger is about a billion, but the locomotive is far less. It's between 15 and 50 million, depending on where you buy it. Very big difference. The capacity that we've created up to date in the Cape Town Container Terminal, we've increased our capacity to 900,000 containers, but this capacity is not fully utilized yet because work is still continuing on paving and construction in the bed to strengthen the key walls, and also continuing to dredge the basin. The dredging of the basin is 95% complete. So although we are increasing capacity to 900,000 containers, we are not there yet. Because of the construction activity that is still taking place in the port. In the port of Moha, we now have a fully functional deep water port. We have two container terminals, two multi-purpose terminals, and one liquid terminal. Devon Pier 1, we have created a dedicated container terminal with a capacity for 750,000 containers. In the Devon Container Terminal re-engineering project has created an additional 300,000 capacity, 300,000 containers capacity thus far. So this will take the capacity in Devon up to 2.9 million containers. Export all line. We have increased capacity from 29 million tons per annum to 53 million tons as we speak, but the capacity will increase to 60 million tons per annum during this financial year. We have a study that is going on that is going to show us how we can increase the capacity further beyond 60 million tons per annum. Port Elizabeth Manganese, we've increased the capacity from 2.8 million tons per annum to 4.8 million tons per annum. And the Devon to Johannesburg pipeline, currently the pipeline transports about 1.5 billion liters per annum. The capacity has been increased at the moment to 4.5 billion liters per annum of works between Durban and Johannesburg, and this will increase to 8.4 billion liters per annum at the end of the year when the pipeline is commissioned. The berthing facilities at Richards Bay, we have built a 400 meter long berth and have dredged it up to minus 14 meters, not 114, but minus 14 meters. That one, the first one is supposed to be a negative number, chart data. The Devon Point car terminal, we have created 3,300 new parking bays, resulting in 80,000 units of annual capacity that is being exported and imported through Devon. We have, with the purchase of the trail suction dredger, we have added 2.3 cubic meters of annual capacity to the port system to be able to dredge. The dredger can dredge up to a depth of 30 meters, and that is the dredger that we bought for about 1 billion rand. Now, the dredger used to be rented, and the cost of renting it is about 1 million rand a day. So it was better that we actually buy our own dredger. Well, we have acquired 50 EMD locomotives, which are deployed on the Palabora to Richards Bay GFB route, and we haul tonnage of 2.7 million tons, inconsistent with other locomotive changes. And at Devon Maiden Wharf, we have built and improved the storage facilities at the Agriport Bulk Terminal. 85,000 ton storage facility for soya beans, together with conveyor and steel shed, has been built there. If I can go into the mega project, Chairperson. The new multi-product pipeline, like I said earlier, the slides at the end, from slide I think 22 to 37, are just for additional information. But this is the report on the new multi-product pipeline. Progress to date, the 16-inch Kendal to Waterloo pipeline was completed on 3 December 2010. The remaining two 16-inch pipelines, PL to Jameson Park to Al Road and Al Road to Lang Lakse, were completed in April 2011. The trunk line, 24-inch Devon to Jameson Park pipeline, is scheduled to be ready for commissioning by the end of July 2011 and is planned to be ready for operation by the end of 2011. The long and the short of this is that the pipeline will be in operation at the end of December 2011, where we will almost double the capacity, as I said earlier, to 8.4 billion liters per annum. The pump stations will be, and the terminals will be completed by 2013, but the pipeline is coming into commission at the end of 2011. The pipeline will be completed in line with the approved board expenditure on the pipeline, which approval was obtained last year in, in November 2010, as well as within the timelines that were agreed to in November 2010 by the board. Devon Harbour, we widened and deepened the Devon Harbour entrance, where the project entails dredging and deepening and widening of the channel on the north side with the provision of a new northern groin, the improvement and strengthening of the south breakwater, and construction of a fixed sand bypass system. What is remaining to be done on the project is the construction of the permanent sand bypass system. Progress, the entrance channel has been widened to 225 meters and dredged to a depth of minus 18 meters. Now the port is able to accommodate new generation container vessels. That take 9,200 TEUs. Queen Mary II, one of the largest passenger vessels in the world, was able to call at Devon. The further re-engineering will be completed during 2012-2013 financial year, and we have completed all the workshops and buildings that we needed for the maintenance of the equipment at the port. I must say that with respect to Durban, our problem really, and the problem that causes major congestion at the port, is at Pier 2. And we have recently, the board has recently approved that we acquire 8 tandem carrier cranes. Now, these tandem carriers can carry about 4, not about, they can carry 4 containers at a time, which will more than double our efficiency at Pier 2 in Devon. So it takes about 12 to 14 months for the cranes to be delivered, and we hope that when they get delivered, we will be able to relieve the congestion in Devon. Although the congestion is not just caused by the efficiency of the cranes, we will be addressing other issues to make sure that the port functions well. Cape Town Container Expansion, I referred to this earlier. The aim was to increase the capacity from 700,000 containers to 900,000 containers and ultimately to 1.4 million containers per annum, whilst also providing a platform for further expansionary programs should future demand exceed planned capacity. Progress, Berth 601 has been upgraded and is fully operational with 4 new ship-to-shore cranes. And these are twin lifts, so they can carry two containers at a time. So these are quite new in South Africa. I don't think there's any other port on the African continent that has those. Goha is in Africa. Yeah. Yeah, but we will be introducing tandem carriers next year. Now, those will be the first on the continent. Not even Moha has been. 6 out of the 8 cranes are fully operational. Dredging of the basin is 95% complete to the planned depth of minus 15 meters. Certain spots are at about minus 15.3 meters. 440 meters of the 1,130 meter long key wall has been dredged to minus 15 meters. Nguha, here, this project entails the provision and construction of basic port infrastructure for the port of Nguha, consisting of breakwater construction, dredging of basin and channels, and the sand bypass system, 5 beds and backup areas, initial landside infrastructure as well as pilot boats and tugboats. Progress, the last section of the key wall was completed in October 2010. The port of Nguha ran a successful poison-free rodent control and monitoring program, and the project environmental manager won the UK Oak Award for this urban raptor project. The project also received 2010 SAICE Award for Most Outstanding Civil Engineering Achievement in Technical Excellence for 2009. Joint winner with Soccer City, now FNB Stadium. Or, I think it's FNB Stadium, now Soccer City. The work on the container terminal is substantially complete, and phase one of the project has been closed out. The last section of the quays has been filled with water, and the dredging contract has been awarded. Dredging of the additional 100 meters of key wall commenced in February 2011, and handover is forecast for November 2011. When complete, 2 additional berths will be available for the handling of container volumes. The project has achieved 3 million LTI 3 hours. LTI are lost time injury rates, so 3 million no injury hours. The iron ore export corridor. The iron ore export project comprises the rail line from Sishen to the port of Saldanha and through the port terminal onto export carrier vessels. The increased demand in basic commodities worldwide has led to the mines increasing their production capacities and resulted in an increase in volumes to be transported to Saldanha for export. The iron ore line consists of three expansion initiatives, all of which are at an advanced stage of execution and capacity created is being utilized. Progress, phase one expansion to 41 million tons per annum. Construction of the reverse osmosis plant is completed and currently is in the commissioning phase. Phase 1B, expansion of 47 million tons per annum. Control software to improve reliability of tiplets, conveyors and reclaimers have been installed. Passing loops, stockyard workshops, upgrade of three stacker reclaimers, modification of conveyors and drives were completed in 2010-11. Phase 1C, which is expansion to 60 million tons per annum, the dredging of the port and installation of mooring hooks to enable dual ship loading was completed. 13 kilometers out of 32 kilometers of track on the Postmaster Glen line has been installed. Structural work on the road over rail bridge was completed, and electrical work on the power grid upgrade is continuing. The export coal line, this program of work package was approved in December 2005. It's called Warrant AYN and AYO. I don't think you need to worry about that. But the the project was the first initiative to simplify and standardize the export coal operation. The scope of this initiative relates to building of 800 jumbo wagons, lead equipping on all locomotives for export coal, and upgrading feasible network feeder lines to 26 tons per axle. Progress. During the 2010-2011, four new substations were completed, Delmas, Argent, Kendal, and Helix Plus. The migration of interlocking interfaces to the optical fiber cable from Richards Bay to Helix Plus was also completed. Formation rehabilitation at Helix Plus, grouting and chair replacements at Tunnel 16, as well as the MLO yard automation project for yard safety were completed, and 81 million tons per annum expansion revised FEL2 study, as well as the 10-year sustaining investment FEL3 projects were also finalized. FELs are studies that we conduct before we do mega project. The locomotive acquisition program, we acquired 110 plus 19E dual voltage locomotives for the coal line from Mitsui. I think that is Van Dalen's big problem. He asked for clarification on that particular acquisition. What I can say is that Mitsui has asked that the price not be disclosed because of commercial reasons. That, so we signed the confidentiality. But the acquisition of the locomotives was done, there was a tender that was done, I think, in 2005. And Mitsui won the contract and supplied locomotives. What we did last year was we increased the number that was in the original tender for purposes of standardization, the number of locomotives that we had bought from Mitsui for standardization, and we used the confinement to do that, because if we already have Mitsui locomotives, there's no point in going out on tender. And so we acquired them in that way, but there had been a tender before. Now, I know Mr. Van Dalen likes saying that Chancellor House is the company that is involved. It isn't. It is.
Chairperson, can I protect Honorable Van Dalen? This time around, it was me. I take full responsibility.
No, but the C-time, he also said it. he repeated it the C-time. Chancellor House was not. The company that was involved is Union Carriage, UCW, Union Carriage Works, which is an old company that started building railways in South Africa over 100 years ago. So, no, it is a South African company. It's a South African company. In fact, Union Carriage Works was almost faced with closure had they not got this contract from the SUI that we supported. Acquisition of 100 plus 43 diesel locomotives from GE to replace the aging fleet at the General Freight business, and acquisition of 44 plus 15 locomotives for the iron ore line, also from Mitsui. If I can go into the future, Chair, because that is what was done in the last 5 years, the amount of work that Transnet did in the last 5 years. Going forward, we will be investing a further 110.6 billion over the next 5 years. The bulk of the money will go into rail, locomotives, wagons, pairway, and it will also go into land and buildings, port facilities, machinery and equipment, and pipeline networks. The projects that we are going to be involved in over the next 5 years are listed on the right of that slide. Iron ore expansion to 60 million tons and beyond, the purchase of locomotives, the pipeline, dual voltage locomotives. These are the purchase of locomotives that use both diesel or electricity, dual voltage locomotives. Devon Container Terminal re-engineering, Moha Container Terminal, Cape Town Container Expansion, acquisition of the old Devon Airport site. I think that figure there of 1.5 billion is wrong, because when we start negotiating with AXA, that is not where we are hoping to do the deal. I think it is conservative on the high side, but maybe I should wait for the negotiations to be finished. And the next slide shows our capital investment and major areas of investment, and the coal line, where we'll be investing 14.5 billion, hoping to increase capacity there to 81 million tons per annum. The ore line, where we're investing 10.2 billion, hoping to increase capacity to 60.7 million tons per annum. General freight, increasing future capacity to 111 million tons per annum, from 73 million tons per annum. Maritime containers in the terminals, increasing our capacity to 6.1 million TEUs, and hopefully the port system will produce 8.3 million TEUs. Bulk terminals, 90.5 million tons per annum, investment of 2.5 billion, and break bulk 1.7 billion, increasing capacity to 14 million tons per annum. And the pipeline, where we will increase capacity to 8.4 billion liters, which is a project that will, the pipeline will be commissioned this year, but it will be finished in the next 2 years. Beyond the next 5 years, we hope to develop the Devon Airport site into a dig-out port equipped with 16 container beds. The first phase will have 4 container beds, and the cost of the first phase is in the region of 50 billion. We have not yet thought how we're going to finance this, because this is beyond 5 years. The picture on the right shows you, the top picture on the right shows you a possible port, the port that will be built, perhaps in the next 10 or 15 years to be completed. But that is what the Devon International Airport site will look like when the port is built. The picture at the bottom, I think, shows you a new Moha container terminal, what we can increase it to beyond the next 5 years. So equipping of the remaining two berths to create capacity of 1.2 million containers. The other projects are Waterberg Coal, where there is an opportunity for domestic and export market coal, where estimate haulage could be between 80 million tons per annum to 135 million tons per annum. We would have to create that capacity in our rail system to transport the coal from the Waterberg. And, of course, in the next 3 to 4 years we have to talk about increasing the iron ore line beyond 60 million tons per annum. Chair, that is the report back on the infrastructure program at Transnet, as well as just a brief outline of what we're going to be doing over the next 5 years and some of the ideas that we have beyond 5 years. From slide 21 to the end of the presentation, this is just in the interest of transparency, additional information on the pipeline project, because there's been a lot of public interest. So this is an update of what is happening with the project. Thank you, Chair.
Noted Mr. Nana, Honorable Dr. Kurno, Honorable Bond, Honorable Van Dalen, Honorable McQueen, and Honorable Chairman.
Well, thanks, Jefferson. May I firstly welcome the presentation by Transnet Group CEO. And also commend your leadership. I realize that the other side of the house is one of your top executives. To this committee, it's an indication that you take us seriously. 2 weeks ago, we had Public Enterprises as a department here attending to a report that was relating to an SOE, and sadly that SOE never bothered to attend, and yet that SOE is the worst performing in our portfolio. So I truly commend you for having shown such seriousness. But having said that, Chair, a few months ago I asked the minister, and again in the budget vote I asked him, but I'm told his response was that he will only respond to my question when I've rejoined the ANC. Now it truly meant that he will never respond to my question. Chair, are you saying you'll never rejoin the ANC? Sageja, is it because you'll never rejoin the ANC? Chair, is that part of this portfolio?
No, you said it.
I think we'll never answer to the question. No, Chair, the Mitsui contract. Mr. Mlifa has just told us that because Mitsui was awarded the initial contract to deliver locomotives, it stood to reason that a subsequent contract be given to them. In my budget speech, I submitted to the minister that was in contravention of the Public Finance Management Act. I don't get it how a separate delivery could be linked to a previous delivery. To me, that was a new contract which required a completely new tendering process. Even if Mitsui would have been given, but the fact of the matter is that it's completely new and it required a new tender process. And with due respect, I submit that the Public Finance Management Act was flouted in this regard. And can I suggest that something be done, but something should be done about it before it becomes an albatross in your neck. And
I find it difficult to comprehend, Chairperson, that Mitsui has asked that the amount involved in this deal should not be divulged on the basis that it's economically sensitive. I find it difficult to comprehend because this is public money, and for God's sake, who is Mitsui to tell us not to divulge such information to the South African public, which is actually paying for the deal? I truly think that as South Africans, we need to know about this. This is not the first major acquisition deal this country has ever embarked on. There have been some in the past, and such figures were in the public domain. And lastly, find time and visit their website. There is some amounts that they have posted in their website. Whilst they are asking you not to divulge this information, on the one hand they do. Thanks.
Thank you, Chairperson, and thank you to Mr. Molefe for a very impressive presentation. This is really food for thought, and I think this is a well researched document and proposal that you put for the committee for the next 5 years. We really appreciate it. And the large delegation of members of Transnet, the executive, but also important that some of the board members attend this presentation. I think that shows it's a team working. And I think it makes a huge impression if board members also attend the briefing with the CEO and his top management. So thank you for that. Three very straightforward questions. On your strategy and your deepening of your harbors in the next 5 years, I assume you haven't stated it here, but I assume you have applied to environmental aspects, that we don't get a repeat of ecological disasters 20 years down the line, to say you've disturbed underflows of the ocean and harbors, it happened in certain of our ports. I just want to have a clarity that you've done those studies and you've applied with an environmental legal situation in this country. Secondly, to implement such an extensive capital infrastructure program, you need top people. And in the previous presentation, DPE referred to possible leakages of your top people that you train because of their expertise being pinched or stolen by private sector. What plans do you have in place to keep your top people highly trained, highly qualified, desperately needed for this rollout for the South African economy for the next 5 to 10 years? What plans do you have in place to retain those key skills which we've invested probably millions in each individual, that they don't leave Transnet and keep the expertise to assist the South African economy to roll out this infrastructure development plan? And then my last question, your railway line investment. It's a huge backlog, if I understand you correctly. And you're going to roll out a railway network that will support the South African economy into the future. Do we have the capacity currently, because of the infrastructure gap, investment gap, that we can, from the current point, support all sectors of the South African economy with your current railway network, and that you can assure this committee that in the rollout of your future network of railways, that we will keep up with the economic growth of the country and support all sectors that will require the rail network that you are talking about. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Yes, the dredging one is so very around it. And I'm just wondering, you know, we go deeper and deeper and bigger, you know, what are the long-term consequences? And therefore, it's very important that we have that understanding. The other thing I want to just refer to is the cost of the pipeline. I see it's still showing at $11.15 billion, the NMPP, and there's been quite a bit in the paper about that doubling. So I just want to understand that. And, you know, I've read some of the background in your report that says, you know, due to the 11 kilometres it was changed, and, you know, in Durban it seems like an awful lot of money to make up that. So and it's still showing us that old amount, so if I could just understand that. It's on page 17. Can answer it when you get a chance, okay? And then I'm very interested in the Durban Dugout Port with the old international airport. And obviously that is already a done deal. Somewhere I've missed something in the Durban setup. Is that bought and signed and sealed already? The Durban Dugout of the old international airport, because at the moment there seems to be a lot of people vying for that, and it seems to me that it's a done deal with you for the dig up. So I'd like some explanation, and possibly if it is all signed and sealed, what did you pay for it?
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to know what is the plans of Transnet in connection with the Saldanha Bay Harbour to make that the import and export hub. I was hearing noises about that we were going to use that also as an import and export, not only for coal or for iron ore, but also for containers and everything else. What is the plans on that? And that is also to take the strain off the road coming into Cape Town and to spread, you know, share the load with Cape Town Harbour, which is also becoming quite strenuous on the harbour. And then we asked questions previously about the maize exports, which has nearly come to a standstill because the machinery at the, I think it was PE Harbour, is not working and it needs upgrading. I see nothing about that in your report either. Or is the export of grain and food for South Africa not important enough for Transnet to give it any attention? And then I want to latch on to what Mrs. Honourable Bowman has said about the increase in the pipeline. It seems awfully extravagant if you have a pipeline of, say, 500 kilometres and you have an 11-kilometre deviation, and then all of a sudden it's double the price. Also that this pipeline, the deviation to the old airport, like Honourable Bowman is saying, we have budgeted for it, it's going there, but we haven't bought the premises yet. So are we understanding it right? We need some clarification on it. So I think you need to tell us a little about the pipeline and what the cost of each, you know, maybe a breakdown of that extra 11 billion rand cost. You know, and I said in my budget speech that it's like budgets for dummies, you know. A billion rand here and a billion rand there, it's, you know, and double 11 billion rand is nothing. I mean, it's a lot of money. It's like 11,000 million rand more. It's incomprehensible. I mean, it's a lot of zeros. And it's nothing half me. It's all just zero, 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 you know. 1 billion is a lot of money in anybody's terms. Thank you.
I will not comment on the Honourable Dummy. Chair, I want to know the following. One of the commitments in IPAP is to localise.
to what extent does the presentation that we have here make progress on the commitment of localization, well, particularly on the projects, and of course the commitment on original equipment, and if not, what the challenges are with them, and you know, what is it that this committee could take up on those challenges and those commitments that have been made. Speaking on local projects, I'd like to venture into asking Chair, and I didn't have enough time to just look at the different areas that are mentioned in this project, to see to the extent of, you know, if one just do a very quick synopsis of our own constituencies that we are in, to what extent does it mirror the improvements with the projects that you have mentioned here in our own constituencies. This is not my constituency, but the previous one, but let me make the example nevertheless. If you look at the here in the Western Cape, the location of where Mitchell's Plain is, for example, it's on a the main road. It's an interchange on Baden Powell towards the N2. Now, if you look at the desirable location of the False Bay Coast, then, for example, Chair, if you look at an idea of where the port is in Cape Town, and let's say you would have any ships that need to be fixed or repaired, would you consider an area like that that is ideally located to be given that sort of project, other than staying in the harbour doing it or wherever they are going? 5 or 6 years ago, when I was in trade and industry, I raised this matter with in my budget vote speech, so you can go back to my budget vote speech where I spoke about local economic development, and I raised this on the basis of really where the area is, but more than that, I'm not sure if it's still east, but it was supposed to be one of government's, there were, in each province, there were two areas chosen by government that were extremely poor. So it was Mitchell's Plain and Khayelitsha. So I raised this both in relation to Mitchell's Plain and Khayelitsha, what I'm saying. So to what extent do you envisage those kind of localization of projects to take shape? And then lastly, Chair, of course, the IPAP 2 speaks about identified for Transnet locomotives, all the things that you have said, you know, the wagons, the coaches, and all of this thing as part of the strategic procurement fleet. I'd like to know what happened to 2007. I mean, what happened to IPAP 1 commitment? I think it was supposed to be done by 2007. Is it ongoing, completed, and does it build from and on the current ones that we are talking? If I may, Chair, I'd wait rather on the response that the CE is going to give on what the two members have raised, and I ask your permission to address you again, depending on the answer.
I think it's a question. I also echo the words, complimentary words, from my colleagues on the leadership of Transnet, the new leadership of Transnet. I'm a very capable CEO, the prime minister. You know, he's striking about the PSC. Wonderful work. And of course, the new board. Now, as lawmakers, we have a responsibility to regularize legislation. If my memory serves me well, the National Port Authority Act had to have some tinkering in order to enable simple one. Number two, about 2 years ago, there was a huge American ship called American Something Express that berthed itself here on the West Coast. And for a very long time, I think about 3 or 4 weeks, it couldn't be liberated from the sand because there was no dredging capacity. I'm actually thrilled that Transnet has now acquired the plans to acquire our own dredger. But you have to think the Americans themselves to travel the seas to come and actually liberate their own ship that has berthed. I mean, it actually exposed our incapacity there. Although, I mean, it has our own problems, but they didn't navigate properly. Right. The third, a quick question, Mr. Bonifa and his team. You know, there's this new move now to go continental, came to Cairo, in terms of the building one colony and ultimately getting other countries on board. So that creates new vistas and challenges also for Transnet. We no longer, in terms of dredging our ports now, like Wuha, Richards Bay, Durban, Cape Town, etc., we're going to increase our capacity beyond the current plan that we have. Because now we've got more clients now, these 26 countries that currently are putting one another in order to establish the first phase of this continental economy. And linked to that is of course the question of job creation. And also I know that Transnet employs about 133,000 people at the moment. And I would like to know, not now, but I mean it would be interesting to know in terms of the new avenues that are opening, what sort of job opportunities are there in order to meet this 5 million target that we have set ourselves in the government in the next 10 years. And then finally, this minor dimension, when you say minor, I assume that it must be below sea level, but let's say you say the new dredger, the dredger we've acquired now, which costs about a billion, can dredge up to 30 meters down. But you mentioned the minus of 15. I went a bit lost it, but I thought 15 was around too shallow superficial. And when you mentioned 30, there was no minus. I don't understand the minus dimension below the meniscus of the seawater, or what is it all about? Or is minus something? What is it lost there in terms of my conception of dimension?
I think we've agreed that members will have a second bite depending on your responses to the questions that have already been asked. But I also wanted to check as to how this investment, you know, would be benefiting, especially rural development. But I think we will be having another meeting on the 28th, in 2 weeks, yeah, where we will actually discuss this more in depth. You may not have to answer this one yet, but I just think that Honorable Mokwena has raised it, because in that meeting we will really get a very clear picture with regard to job creation skill and skills development. We can leave that for the next meeting. Over to you, Mr.
Chair. On the Mitsui procurement, whether it was not irregular expenditure, there is in the rules, procurement rules, there is an allowance for a confinement, and the confinement can be done to one or two companies, as long as the reasons are provided to the board, or depending on the amount, to the investment committee or the acquisition and disposal committee. Once that is done prior to the acquisition of the asset, so you do a confinement before you actually do the acquisition. In this case, that is what happened, and so it's not irregular. It would have been irregular if staff had gone and acquired the additional locomotives and then went back to seek a confinement. So the correct processes were followed, such that there was no infringement of the PFMA. But just, I don't know if Roderick would like to add. Roderick is head of our internal audit and is a partner at Ernst & Young. I don't know if you would also agree with the view that, with your professional experience, that this particular tender on Mitsui in any way was irregular expenditure, or it was against the PFMA rules.
Yeah, I think
please speak to the microphone. We'll allow Roderick to add on what
I think just to add to what the CEO has said, the procurement rules, and specifically with regard to confinements, are quite specific around the criteria that would need to be satisfied before a procurement can take place under a confinement. And those would include urgency, those would include restrictive market, those would include instances where that confinement is focused on a service provider or a supplier that is already delivering to Transnet, that capability is known to the organization, that is already delivering to the organization. And those are some of the criteria that would need to be satisfied. I think, as Mr. Molefe has said, that process was then looked into, was followed. The fact that Mitsui were already delivering under a procurement program to Transnet meant that some of the confinement criteria were satisfied, and to that extent they did satisfy the confinement criteria before going ahead to procure.
No, if Mr. Moyo would like to add. Mr. Moyo is the chairperson of our audit committee and has been the chairperson for some time.
Thanks, Chairman. I don't think there's anything more to add to what Brian and Roderick have said.
Chair, on the second question of divulging the price of the Mitsui locomotives, we have signed a confidentiality agreement. It was part of the condition of doing business with Mitsui, rightly or wrongly, but we have signed a confidentiality agreement. Mitsui did not want their pricing strategy to be revealed to the market. And in my experience, that is not abnormal for a supplier to say, I don't want my competitors to know how I price. So that, because if they know how I price, in the next tender or in other tenders, they will see what my pricing strategy is. And I don't want to reveal it because it is proprietary. So he says, I will sell you these locomotives that you want from me, but I just don't want you to divulge at what price I sold them. So that was fine, that we had the confidentiality with Mitsui, and unfortunately we are not at liberty to make public disclosure in terms of that confidentiality agreement. But in our financial records, you can see how and how much was spent on locomotives and so on, and we are in a position to say that we do not think that there was nothing untoward in their price, and it was very competitive. It is just that we are not in a position to reveal their pricing strategy, but we can vouch that it was competitive. I don't know if Roderick, what your impression is, or Zola, who is our also acts as our legal advisor, would like to add on to that.
Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Josie. No, there is nothing to add at this point. The confidentiality agreement unfortunately binds us to the terms of the agreement unless it is waived by me.
That's fine, you may ask. Thanks for your indulgence, Chair. Mr. Mlupa, can I suggest that fine, I take your point that the whoever defined it rightly or wrongly, you are now into an agreement with Mutsuwe. But can I check with you if it's possible for Transnet to check the legality? I know it may cost you money if you can afford it. Check the legality of such a confidentiality agreement in the light of the fact that this is public money. Thank you.
I think that must have already been done before. Honorable September, I'll allow you now to get into
it. I submit that on both issues, we've heard what Transnet is saying. It is up to this committee to go and seek their own legal opinion on this matter, and we should do that, because it's about us satisfying ourselves, and I don't think it will be right to just make an allegation and us not doing a little bit more than the allegation. My suggestion would be we must go and do our own legal opinion on the matter.
Because I think, without asking the question, I think Transnet would have sought legal advice on that before they even signed. Is it legal for them to go that way? So I think let us leave it on the note that Honorable September is just right. You may go.
Chair, on the environmental aspects of dredging, I'm rightly told that actually we don't only dredge the ports. All the time our dredges operate, and they actually also dredge the beaches, because the sand keeps falling into the sea, and so we have to dredge it, and that is why we have in certain areas wide beaches. That is probably because our dredger has just gone past. But Mr. Kumudu Pitela is here, and he's the former head of the Transnet National Ports Authority. I don't know if you want to add a comment on how the environmental aspects of dredging are addressed.
Thank you, Chair. It's indeed true. It's a matter of procedure that on any aspect related to dredging, be it maintenance dredging that we do on a routine basis, on a daily basis, and capital dredging that's associated with projects, is that part of a project plan will be the seeking approval at sort of tier level of government, local, provincial, and national government for environmental approval. So that's a matter of process and procedure. It is done. We don't do any project before getting those approvals. In fact, in a couple of cases, we've been unable to continue because we didn't get those approvals. There was maybe a second issue around... the depth of dredging that you find in our system is that it varies from entrance channels to tanning basins and to the berths themselves, and it varies from port to port. So the new dredger has got the capability of dredging up to 30 meters just because of that variability. Richards Bay is a lot deeper. The entrance channels were 22 meters. The entrance channel for Devon is now 18 meters. Around the berths, ranges from 9 to 15.5. That's the reason why you have a dredger that's a bit able to do the various depths. And on the aspect of the work, that the capacity we have can be utilized within our port system. And within outside, is we used to cooperate with neighboring countries in terms of assisting them with their dredging program. Our work internally, the country has increased with the upgrade of our ports, and we have only sufficient capacity to do ourselves, to only do the ports ourselves, our own ports. But at this stage, there is a global oversupply. So there's a lot of assistance that's been provided to our neighboring countries, you know, out of China, Japan, and the work that was done in the Middle East in terms of the dredging that was done there, which is now been deployed into the neighboring countries. So for the time being, there is a sufficient capacity to cater for cover most of the questions related to dredging.
Gotcha. I think that takes care of the environmental aspect as well as whether or not 15 meters is not too shallow, as well as our activities on the African coastline with respect to dredging. So those questions are answered. We can continue. The retention of senior managers. I think, Chair, when I arrived at Transnet, more than half of the executive committee was in acting positions. Within 2 weeks, they were confirmed. They are all permanent in their positions. They were moved around, and they are all permanent in their positions. We have had discussions about this. We went out overnight to the waterberg, had a poikikos competition, and agreed to work together. And so as a team, I think we are gelling, and I would be surprised if any one of them is thinking of leaving. I think that if any one of them was planning to leave, I would personally know what the reasons are. But I have no reason to suspect that any one of the executives is unhappy. I did not bring in new people. We just used the existing people that know the business far much better than I do, and that have a commitment to the business. We just shifted them around, and we had very long discussions about how we're going to do performance monitoring of all the executives, which is now going to be done quarterly rather than annually. So, and everybody's quite happy with that, and that is cascading down to the whole organization. So I'm quite confident that this executive team will stay at least for the 5 years that I have a contract.
Who won the competition?
You see, Quakey Goes is a very... So I think I was in a team with Moira Moses and... who else was in our team? And Carl Sotikwa. And we won, but mainly because Moira did some dumplings that she put into the Quakey, and that was a winner with the judges. The judges. No. Actually, I didn't. I was just chopping the vegetables and meat. But the spicing was done by Carl, and Moira was the supervisor, and she did the. Yeah. So, but the other poiki pots were actually excellent as well. I must say that the Richard Valihu put up quite a. An interesting combination, as well as Mr. Vizela, that it was like a very interesting thing. Can't you say it was like sushi? Oh, an engineering solution, yeah. But we are working quite well together. We are available to each other, and we support each other quite well. I think that is something that is happening. If I can mention that is I think the most important decision was that we will stick together and that we will meet our as far as possible meet our 100-day target. Those are the most important things. But there was very little discussion of business on that night. We had a previous meeting where we did our strategic planning, but on that night all we did was just talk about just the big issues in the organization and where intervention is required. On the railway investments that we are doing and whether or not we have capacity to support sectors of the economy, and whether we can keep up with economic growth, and I believe that means whether we can keep up with increasing demand. What is happening here is that Transnet is in a position where we're actually not able to meet the demand for freight transport, which is why there has been a slow migration from rail to road. We hope to reverse that trend with the capital investment as well as the focus on increasing the volumes of commodities that are being transported. And so until we are able to mop up everything that is available to be transported, from a freight logistics point of view, I think we are actually not we are not able to see what the full potential of the South African economy is. So we as Transnet are holding back the potential of the South African economy because we are not transporting everything that needs to be transported. And I think that point has been made quite repeatedly to the executives, and the importance of what we're doing is that there are people out there who work very hard. There are people out there who have jobs that need to be retained, and there are people out there who are manufacturing and producing goods, agricultural goods, and so on. And by us not being able to transport it, we're doing a disservice to the whole of South Africa. And that is a matter that we intend to address as a matter of agency. I don't know if, Mark, you would like to add on the way that we are planning to meet the demand for freight logistics over the next couple of years.
Our planning process is quite sophisticated. We've got freight demand models working for up to 30 years, a long-term infrastructure plan that comes out of that, which flows into our five-year capital plan. And then we have, as we get closer, we've got some significant studies that are currently underway. One in the eastern region, looking at all the demand for all the major commodities, coal, magnetite, ferrochrome, etc., developing a solution, operational and capital, to essentially a master plan to handle all those commodities for the next 20, 30 years. And we're doing similar studies for iron ore, manganese, container traffic. So I think the planning process is fairly sophisticated and taking a very long-term view, and not only an internal Transnet view, also understanding what is needed to satisfy demand for South Africa, identifying what part of that demand Transnet is going to satisfy, and what part of that demand we'll need industry to fulfill or industry to contribute towards.
Chair, on the cost of the pipeline, I think on page 17, the cost that is reflected on page 17 is the cost that is remaining. So not what it has cost us thus far, but what it is still going to cost us going forward. And so if you go to page 29, you'll see a breakdown of the additional cost, which is inflation, time-related cost, engineering development, and a growth allowance of about 20%, which is a reconciliation of the original February 2008 board approval and the board approval of November 2010. I don't know if you want to add anything more.
The assurance that I think Transnet does everything that it possibly can to bring its projects in on schedule and within its budget, and we've certainly achieved that on our rail and marine projects. I think the pipeline has been a very complex project, and if anything, we perhaps underestimated its difficulty and complexity and how many barriers there would be to delivering a project of this size. The other thing which we do need to consider is that this pipeline is absolutely essential to the lifeblood of this country and to our economy. And we only have one pipeline that feeds from Durban through to the Gauteng economic heartland. So we needed to, in engineering this pipeline,
ensure that it would be reliable, that it would be built to national key point standards, that it would have sufficient capacity to see the country through for many years to come, and in fact it has been engineered with a design life of 70 years. The other thing is that the project has been designed in such a manner that we are putting the bulk of the infrastructure in now. So the main trunk line is going to see us through for the foreseeable future. But as capacity grows within the country, so we can add to various phases, but the bulk of the expense and the cost is already being delivered now. So, yep, that's we have perhaps been conservative in our allowances, and I'm hoping, and the group CE is holding me to it, that we can deliver this project at a better cost than what we forecast at the moment. But as those costs change, and we are trending down quite substantially at the moment, we will, as we've always done with this project, be very transparent and make that information available.
I just would like to understand, because according to the explanation, the report that we had, it would seem that 11 kilometres of pipeline was what caused, and the redirection of that in the Durban setup is what caused that huge increase. Now, am I to understand that there is more to it than just that section of pipeline, because that's what's coming across in the report, and it just seems out of sync.
Yeah. If I could perhaps refer the committee to page 31. I think there were a number of barriers, and certainly the fact that we had to move our terminal from the old Durban Airport site to Island View was one reason which adds cost to the project, but it most definitely wasn't the only reason. There have been a number. Just in terms of the physical barriers which we've had to cross, there were 500 odd wetlands crossings which we had not anticipated when the initial feasibilities were done, and that requires a completely different type of construction to obviously ensure that we're protecting the environment that we're going through. There were, we've just provided the committee with some of the barriers that we've had to overcome. We had to acquire land from 900 different landowners, and that process of acquiring the right of way took a lot longer than we'd anticipated. And I think with any big mega project like this, if it takes you longer to deliver the project than you'd initially anticipated, your costs do escalate quite substantially. I think it was, as I said, a number of different reasons, not only the fact that we had to relocate our terminal, which has caused the schedule of the project to move out quite substantially, and have therefore impacted price, the cost as well.
Chair, if I can add, the CEO of the Transnet Pipelines is a gentleman called Mr. Charles Moller, who joined Transnet, I think, in 1968. And when we went for the excursion to the waterbed, there was an option to go for a massage, and he indicated that nobody has ever touched him other than his wife, so he refused to take off his shirt. So I think that must be noted as well. The man is a man of integrity. He would not even have a massage at a strange place in the waterbed.
I hope Transnet do some work. They seem to have pointy foot evenings and massages after the water bird or something. I'm getting a bit worried here.
It's just on the doubling of the pipeline. We do understand that escalations can take place, but I mean, as a committee, we must also send a clear message that, you know, this mustn't be a trend. It must be an exception rather than a trend, because we see it in Eskom, we see it everywhere. Everything is just doubling, and it's just becoming, you know, a lot of billions of rand extra. And I mean, if that is a trend that's going to continue, then I mean, we're going to have a big problem. So we need to send that message that although this might be an exception, it mustn't become the norm. Please.
Chair, we will be attending to that, and I hope it won't happen again. We regard this as school fees. We had to pay our school fees. We did the major 24-inch pipeline. The cost went out of hand. But the important thing about this whole experience is that we are now in a much better position to do the next pipeline from the school fees. It's very expensive, I agree. But school fees, nevertheless, we now have the expertise and the knowledge to do a pipeline elsewhere on the continent or in South Africa to take on the next big project. Chair, the dig out of the old airport. How much we paid for it? We haven't paid for it yet. The land still belongs to AXA. We must still negotiate. What I was saying earlier is that we've got the provision of about 1.5 billion to pay for the land. But we have not, no work has started on the dig out. It's just, yes. So it hasn't, not, no work has taken place. We have not even bought the land yet. Plans with the development of Saldanha into a multi-purpose harbour to share the load with Cape Town. I'm not aware that we have any long-term plans to do this, but I don't know if Mr. Kanti wants to.
Thanks, GCE. Chair, the Saldanha port is a major bulk and break bulk export port, bulk in the form of iron ore commodity from the Northern Cape, which goes to the port, and some break bulk, which is some steel coils and a few other smaller break bulk commodities that go through there. The plan, in our 5-year plan, is to increase the capacity that is currently being exported out of Saldanha, which is on the iron ore side. And also, we do have currently studies that we are conducting internally within Transnet, which are not yet finalized, to look at the possibility of moving other bulk commodities out of Saldanha. But currently, the approved plans are for increasing the iron ore exports as a major bulk export facility on the west coast, and as I've indicated, together with smaller break bulk commodities out of there. There are no plans to build a container facility out of Saldanha currently. It's mainly focused on bulk and break bulk.
So Kali, may as well deal with the next question, which is machinery at the airport with respect to agriculture, which is getting old.
Thank you, GCE Chairman. On this question, we've engaged on this question with the Honourable Van Dalen previously, and it's not the PE port, Chairman. It's the East London port, and this really relates to the East London grain elevator and silos. I must just indicate that as part of the collection of import-export terminals that we operate at Transnet, we also operate agricultural bulk import-export terminals as well. And at the East London facility, that has historically been used for the import of wheat and export of maize products out of East London. And over the years, what has happened is there's been significant degradation that was experienced
at that facility in East London. And following a concern that was raised by our Transnet Capital Projects team in 2007 as to the safety critical aspects of that facility, we then conducted further studies that ultimately led to a stop certificate being issued with that facility, primarily because of the high level of safety critical issues that were experienced at that facility. What we then did from there, Chair, was that given the fact that that needed to continue as an export-import facility for grain and products, we then approved the funding of major capital work to upgrade the facility to deal with the safety critical aspects. And the reason for the stop certificate was that we didn't want to be in a position where we're continuing with the operation of a facility which could at any point result in major safety issues like loss of life and the rest. As we currently stand, the facility has been brought back to operation. We currently handle roughly 20,000 tons per month out of that facility. The May month was a particularly strong month where we handled roughly 70,000 tons, but this is a spike that was experienced at that facility. And the major capital work to upgrade that facility up to a level where it can continue then to support the growth in grain exports and imports is the work that will continue for the foreseeable future. But I think going forward, the other internal study which is still taking place internally within Transnet is that we need to find a proper working model for the support of import and import for the agricultural sector. Because at the moment, Transnet is not able to predict the changes or the fluctuations in demands in demand and supply on both sides in terms of exports and imports. And what we're looking at now with the internal study is as to what is the most appropriate model, working together with the agricultural sector, for these very important facilities to be operated optimally going forward. And that's some of the internal work that is currently taking.
Chair, the next question was about the Jamaican Express, which was trapped in the sand. I don't know if Mr. Pitella would like to comment about what happened there, what the reasons were. That there was a liner that was trapped in the sand.
Thank you, thank you, Chairman. As indicated by the member, is that it was no fault of the Port Authority in a sense that cautions were given in terms of the direction that the vessel was taking, and indeed it eventually ran aground. The safety of navigation beyond the port limits is not the competence of the Port Authority. It's actually sitting with the South African Maritime SAMSA. Basically, that's their responsibility. And the capability that we have, in terms of dredging, unfortunately, won't solve the problem. In the sense that it's our dredging is of a routine maintenance nature, and the vessel ended up in an area that was not earmarked or demarcated for passage. That's the result thereof. And in terms of how you rescue a situation is basically around salvage of providing equipment, mainly towage, to try and pull them out of the situation rather than moving sand. Thank you.
Chair, the next question was about job creation and the 5 million jobs target and what Transnet's contribution is going to be. We are taking in artisans, trainee, train drivers, and people that are being trained in port operations, the School of Ports, School of Rail.
rail engineering and the School of Rail, we are training in more than what we need, hopefully because the people can be absorbed in other parts of the business. But more importantly, the South African National Defense Forces program for military skills development, which is where they take in young people, mainly unemployed, to come into the army or the defense force for 2 years. We are targeting those that are coming out of virtuously, because when they leave the defense force, they become unemployed again. But these are people with a high level of discipline, having been to the army for 2 years and so on, and bringing them into these programs. In fact, we have recruited close to 200 at the moment who have come out of the military skills development program of the SANDF to come in to be trained as artisans. That is our, we have specific job targets that I did not bring here about how many jobs we will create in the next 5 years. I don't know if Mr. Vali wants to add something from rail engineering.
I don't think you need to go, you know, into the details of the jobs and skills, job creation and skills development, because I said earlier on we will still engage,
yes.
I think in 2 weeks then we can go into we would be expecting a full report on
that. And therefore the last question is on the benefits for rural development, our activities for rural development. We I think have just committed to improving our service to the agricultural sector with respect to the transporting of agricultural products and the improvement of our bulk agricultural port terminals. In particular in the Eastern Cape, where we are talking about the East London agriculture bulk terminals, we think that more needs to be done to improve the service that we're offering, as well as more capacity for rail for agriculture, which will come with the purchase of new locomotives and wagons. Thank you, Chair. Yes, Chair.
I think this then
legislation governing the National Ports Authority, actually after investing about close to 16 billion at the port of Muha, the legislation does not give us a deemed license, because it was during the time when construction was still taking place. It is something that we're taking up with the Department of Public Enterprises and the Department of Transport. But the legislation also says that the National Ports Authority needs to be corporatized. In the instance where we already have a port regulator, we have an authority and a regulator, we think that we need to engage further with the Department of Transport and the Department of Public Enterprises about how government envisages that a port authority must be corporatized.
Honorable Nana, I'm sorry, I need to say this.
No.
Thanks. I'm happy that finally the current leadership at Transnet will be doing something about this London. Phyllis and some of them who have been around would attest to the fact that I've been pleading with the previous leadership that something has got to be done, otherwise that city is dying a very slow death.
Mm.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Isla London.
Thank you so much. Mr. Mlefa and your team. I think members have already commended you for the seriousness in which you take this committee. In fact, in demonstrating it by bringing, you know, top officials of Transnet with you to the committee. This can only serve to you know, improve relations between the committee and your leadership. You will, I think some of you have been before our committees before, and you'll actually find this a very relaxed meeting. That this committee is not angry. It gets angry when you make it angry. It will seriously criticize you when you make it angry, and but it will also give praise where it's due. And we think you have demonstrated the seriousness. It's not the seriousness with which you take this committee, but how you take your work seriously. You see. And all the officials that you have brought, because they could have given, especially when you're not in the office, they could have given other reasons to go and do other things other than their work. But they thought it is important for them to be here. And also members of the board who have accompanied you. We really appreciate that. We don't only want to see members of the board when we are cross, you know, when they have to come and account, tempers are really flaring. We really do appreciate that. I would like to actually congratulate those whom you said positions have now been confirmed. And on behalf of the committee, wish them all well during their term of tenure. I think with regards to this issue around the increase on the pipeline, you know, it would have assisted us a great deal if the committee had been warned before, because there was a lot of unhappiness from amongst members of the committee, because I think most of us read it in the newspaper, and that doesn't bode well for us. So I think, you know, like you said, the school fees that you had to pay, so I think let that also go for the communication between ourselves, the committee, and you know, that we actually improve on that, so that we'd be warned before we read about it in the newspapers that there will be this thing coming. I think that brings us to the end of this meeting, and thank you all for attending the meeting and your valuable input. Thanks. The meeting is adjourned.